You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, listeners, it's that time of year again, and I'm going to ask a favor of you if you enjoy Kick-Ass News and want to keep us going. In order to support our show, we'll need the help of some great advertisers. And in order to find great advertisers, we'll need to learn a little bit more about you. So please, go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little better. That way, we can show advertisers just how great our listeners are. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can choose to enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and thanks for listening. It's happened to all of us. Right before an important presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Brother Inkvestment Tank Printers help put a stop to this and can literally change the way you ink. With your choice of up to 1 or 2 years of ink included in box, Inkvestment Tank helps eliminate the expense and hassle of frequently buying and replacing ink cartridges. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Just 2 weeks ago, a jury in a New York federal courtroom found Joaquin El Chapo Guzman guilty on 12 criminal counts, including engaging in a continuing criminal enterprise, conspiracy to launder narcotics proceeds, international distribution of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and other drugs, and use of firearms. Now, the man who reigned as the most dangerous and prolific drug lord in the world faces mandatory life in prison without chance of parole. DEA Special Agent Jack Riley says sitting in a lonely cell for the rest of his life is a fittingly pathetic end for a narco-terrorist who flooded America with cocaine, meth, and heroin, murdering thousands of innocent people in the process. And he should know because for 30 years, Jack Riley led the manhunt for El Chapo, and now he's written about it in a new memoir titled Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. Today, Jack joins me on the podcast to discuss how El Chapo first appeared on his radar while working on a classified task force to catch another drug kingpin, Pablo Escobar. He reveals how Chapo cleverly wrangled the cocaine trade from the Colombians, how he saw America's growing opioid epidemic as an opportunity to branch out into meth and heroin, and how El Chapo managed to run a multi-billion-dollar drug empire from a Mexican prison. That is to say, until he one day up and decided that he didn't want to be in prison anymore and walked right out through one of his famous underground tunnels. Jack discusses being on the dangerous front lines of the war on drugs as the head of the DEA's El Paso, Texas branch, how it led to a $100,000 price on his head, and what he learned about policing the border, how drugs get into America, and where they go from there. Then he reveals how El Chapo escaped capture so many times and how the Mexican government had to postpone a raid on his compound because of actor Sean Penn. Plus, we talk about the El Chapo trial, the U.S. opioid epidemic and what needs to be done to address it, criminal justice reform, Donald Trump's wall, and Trump's wild assertion that El Chapo had put a hit out on him. Coming up with DEA Special Agent Jack Riley in just a moment. Thank you. Jack Riley spent his DEA career combating Mexican and Colombian cartels and drug-related gang violence, and for 30 years, Riley was at the center of the hunt for the world's most wanted drug lord, Joaquin Guzman, better known as El Chapo. At the time of his retirement, Riley was the highest-ranking career special agent at the DEA, serving as the organization's second-in-command, overseeing global drug enforcement efforts. Now he writes about it in his new memoir, Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. Jack Riley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, Jack, I got to be honest, I'm probably not alone when I say that most of my reference points for the war on drugs come from watching the Netflix series Narcos. How close is the reality of your work to the fictional depictions?
You know, it's very similar. Both of those guys, Javier and Steve Murphy, I worked with for many years. So it's closer to the truth than a lot of people think.
Really? I was just watching the new season, The Narcos Mexico, and I'm curious, did you know the agent that was killed down there?
Kiki Camarena.
Right.
I came on the job right after that occurred.
That must have been an interesting time to be coming in then.
Yeah, it really was. It was a time when our focus was changing. We were expanding as an agency, and I think the country was just getting used to what we were up against.
And you began your career at the DEA in Chicago, and you talk about being frustrated at the time with just busting small-time street dealers. You say back then law enforcement was too focused on metrics. What do you mean by metrics, and what did you want them to focus on back then?
Well, it was apparent to me after working as a young agent on the street that we were affecting arrests and in some cases making communities safer, but we were doing nothing to attack the organizations. In other words, the Chapo Guzmans of the world and the apparatus that supports what the cartels do. Mm-hmm. And at that time, our scorecard was simply metrics. How many people were arrested? How many drugs were seized? How many guns were seized? How much money did you seize? And don't get me wrong, those are very important indicators as to how we're doing. But I think the impact of our investigations on organizations is far more important.
And it sounds like that was a fight that you fought off and on through most of your career at the DEA, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a couple schools of thought on how to do it. My thing had always been, I want to see impact on the community, or I want to see the organizations dismantle. Yeah, it's kind of like the old four-legged table. If you take one leg out of that table, it remains standing. When you go after the organization, you try to make it cease to exist.
After being in Chicago for a while, you went to D.C. to join this classified task force that had been commissioned by President Bush 41 to catch Pablo Escobar. Now, I know that a lot of that is still classified, but what can you talk about that?
Well, I think it was the realization that law enforcement in general across the globe needed to do something different. And I think that's where I really learned the importance of going after the head of the organization and the organization itself. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the project was designed to do and share information with our counterparts overseas so they could make a difference there too.
And if I have this right, this is where you first heard the name El Chapo, correct?
It was. I think it's important to note that at that point, we were really concentrating on the Colombian issue with Medellin and Cali, Colombia. And the Mexican cartels, as we know them today, really had not formed. They were basically loosely tied smugglers at that point, based in geographical areas of Mexico. And other than marijuana and some black tar heroin, they really were not narcotic traffickers.
So at the time, did your colleagues or supervisors at the DEA or other law enforcement agencies see Guzman as a big player?
Yeah, we began hearing bits and pieces about this logistics genius who had developed various and ingenious ways to smuggle illegal goods into the U.S. I mean, Chapo's famous, obviously, for tunneling. So he was also extremely hands-on in the management of those roles. And I think, he is a mass murderer, in my opinion, but he's also one heck of a good corporate CEO if you look at the organization he set up.
Yeah, you acknowledge that El Chapo was shrewd in the way that he gradually was able to subvert the Colombian cartels and take over the cocaine trade. How did he manage to do that?
Well, you know, we had been, obviously, all the agencies had been fairly successful in taking care of the ports of entry when you look at South Florida and the Caribbean Theater, which was largely occupied by the Colombians. And when we did that, they had to shift the way they operated. And the logical place they went was to Mexico. So there were a few figures then, Chapo being one of them, who began transporting cocaine for the Colombian traffickers into the United States. And one of the things Chapo did, I think, that really set him apart was early on when they would transport, say, 500 kilos for the Colombians and deliver it to the Colombian surrogates, say, in Los Angeles, they would be paid a fee, you know, $2,000 a kilo. Mm-hmm. Well, what Chapo did was he said, we'll move that for you, but you're going to give us 100 kilos. So he now had a far more profitable product that he could already use, existing smuggling routes that he had developed and others had developed long before that, when they were smuggling all kinds of goods, from illegal chili peppers to counterfeit blue jeans, anything they could get to the U.S. border that would turn a profit. But now they had cocaine.
So while the Colombians were just using him as a delivery system, he was taking the cocaine that he was being paid in and then building his own market in the U.S., huh?
That's exactly right. He was building a better car.
Now, he also controlled the cocaine processing, which later came in handy because he already had all this infrastructure in place to start producing heroin and meth when that came into vogue.
I think that's a really important distinction. And, of course, now we're dealing with fentanyl, which is a synthetic heroin, 40 to 50 times stronger than street heroin, which has no growing season. It's not dependent on soil or rain. They can produce it all year round, as with methamphetamine. So, again, Chapo saw the market in the United States and other places in the world, and he did everything he could to build his business around that.
El Chapo saw what was going on with the opioid epidemic in the U.S., and probably realized what was going on sooner than U.S. law enforcement did. Is that what led him to branch out into meth and heroin as well?
I think you're exactly right. And, you know, I can use the example of Chicago, my hometown. I did return back there to run the DEA division. And that was about 2010. We began seeing the real abuse of prescription drugs begin to start filtering into society. And, of course, at some point, doctors stop prescribing. Pharmacists say, enough's enough. You can't steal it from your grandmother's medicine cabinet anymore, but you are addicted to opioids. And your next step is to take that long, dark road down to cheap, high-potency heroin. And I think Chapo saw that coming, and he changed his business model to make sure that he was in a position to profit.
And you were also DEA special agent in charge of St. Louis for a period where you personally witnessed how bad meth was getting. In fact, in a lot of ways, Missouri was really ground zero for the meth epidemic. But you had a hard time convincing the brass in D.C. to take it seriously. Why weren't they interested in what you had to say?
Well, at that time, it was mostly methamphetamine in St. Louis. And the reason I believe that is because it hadn't really crossed the Mississippi River on its way eastbound. Mm-hmm. So much of the country had not seen what the Midwest had seen in terms of the methamphetamine problem. And certainly all the smaller mom-and-pop labs, all the addiction issues, what it did to small rural towns, overwhelming, you know, the healthcare services and police in many cases. So, yeah, it took a while to get the message to Washington that we need to do something at the federal level to try to control it.
Part of this time, Chapo was able to run his drug cartel while serving a 20-year prison sentence. And I know that Escobar did something similar when he essentially chose to go to prison to get out of the line of fire during one of these bloody drug wars among the cartels. Was there a similar motivation when Chapo went to prison?
Quite frankly, when he went to prison, he was in a safer situation to maintain his organization because his rivals had a hard time getting to him. And he ran his organization as if he was out. I'm not sure, but I think while he was in prison, he fathered 5 or 6 children.
Really?
I mean, he had the total run of the prison. And Now, he did decide it was time to leave the prison once the United States and Mexico seriously began talking about extradition.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk in the book about how El Chapo loved the women, and I know that came out in the trial that he was procuring women as young as 13 or something like that and calling them his vitamins for the day.
Yeah, he had quite an appetite, and towards his later years, prior to his last capture, it really consumed him, and I think he made some very, very bad calls. For the first part of his career, he was really under the radar. He stayed much of the time in a remote area of Sinaloa, but then he began gradually coming down to populated areas, primarily to enjoy life.
Going back to your time in Chicago, which I think you came back to Chicago several times during your career, and one thing that comes out that was interesting to me is El Chapo's U.S. hub wasn't really L.A. or Miami, San Diego, the places that folks like me would usually think of as being hubs for drug action. Instead, he was trafficking straight from Mexico to Chicago. What was the significance of Chicago to his operation?
Well, I think you have to look at his genius in that. I mean, that's why many Fortune 500 companies are located in and around the Chicago area. It's in the center of the country, extremely strong interstate highway systems, truckings and rails, all those things that make Chicago very, very easy for traffickers to work in. Also, Chicago, I think, is the third or fourth largest Mexican population outside of Mexico, which really gave him an opportunity and, of course, the people that work for him to hide amongst thousands of hardworking Mexican Americans.
And he had some pretty bad dudes coming up to Chicago to run his operation and take things over from kind of just the run-of-the-mill street gangs. I think you said that you really got worried when the Zetas started to move into Chicago, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because technically at that time, they really truly were a former military unit, and they were grasping control based off fear and intimidation and obviously the many murders that they were responsible for at Chapo's direction in Mexico.
And things really start to heat up when you're transferred to run the DEA operation in El Paso. Then you were in the heart of Chapo country and right in his crosshairs. How dangerous was it for you and the other agents down there?
Well, it was a time in which Juarez, which is the sister city of El Paso, literally a stone throw over the Rio Grande River, was really a battle zone. Chapo was battling the remnants of two other cartels, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people being killed. So it was a time you had to pay attention. And what I was most concerned about, obviously, were the safety of our employees, many of whom lived right on the border, and some actually resided in Juarez. So we certainly didn't want to make them less safe so that he could intimidate or potentially kidnap.
And in fact, didn't El Chapo actually put a hit out on you?
He did. Shortly after I got there, kind of in a naive move by me, I had granted an interview to the newspaper, and in that interview I said quite clearly, I was here to disrupt his organization and do whatever we could do to bring him to justice. What I didn't know is that the sister newspaper based in Juarez, Chapo had a piece of or had people in there. So they soon found out kind of the open air challenges that I made. And shortly after that, some of our Mexican counterparts notified us that they had picked up information that he had put a bounty on my head and was looking to have my head cut off.
Wow. And at one point, some of his thugs tried to follow you home in the middle of the night, huh?
Yeah, they did. And we never really knew exactly if that was their intent. But they sure got my attention, and it was about a 40-mile cruise up the interstate trying to get away from them, and I couldn't. And finally, I pulled into a deserted school play lot, and I only had a small pistol with me, and I thought, well, if this is it, this is it. We're going to have to, you know, fight this out. And all of a sudden, right at the very end, both of the cars fired up and took off out of the area. So I don't know if that was meant to scare me, or if they lost their nerve, or if whoever their boss was told them to back off.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Jack Riley when we come back. In just a minute. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then, simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. One more time, betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. Now, I remember during 2016, Donald Trump claimed that El Chapo had put out a hit on him, supposedly because he was cracking down on the border. You're someone who actually did have a hit put out on him by El Chapo. What did you think of that? Was that just BS, or did you ever hear any talk of a price on Trump's head?
No, I never. No. I remember reading about that, but I never saw it in any official intelligence reports. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Chapo would do something like that, but I don't have any, you know, firsthand knowledge that that occurred.
And in one of the more farcical moments from your time in El Paso, the Mexican Attorney General invites you down to Mexico to view their anti-drug operation in action. Were you very impressed by that?
No, as a matter of fact, I was. The whole time we were down there, it was very clear that they were trying to show that they were doing whatever they could with the military to suppress the cartels. A funny story about that is when they flew us into the mountains where they were going to attack these marijuana fields, we flew on an old vintage Russian helicopter. And when we got on board, the thing was leaking everything, oil, you name it. And of course, the pilots couldn't speak a lick of English. And so we're on the thing, and they handed us bulletproof vests. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we doing here? But what they wanted us to do was to sit on the vests. So as the helicopter flew over the fields, the traffickers, I guess, frequently shot up, and they didn't want to come in through the bottom of the copter.
Yeah, throughout the story, you talk about having a difficult time convincing the Mexican authorities to actually go after El Chapo, and even having trouble convincing local sheriffs in your jurisdiction down there along the border to actually enforce the law and go after the bigger fish. The attitude with a lot of sheriffs was, you know, it's not our problem. It's just passing through.
Absolutely. And many of those sheriffs along the border, some of them are just flat-out heroes. They're very poorly funded and resourced, so they had a tough job just maintaining day-to-day in certain areas. I think our problem at that point was building relationships with our Mexican counterparts, which was really important down the road because we could have never captured Chapo or other high-value targets without the assistance of them, and that took years to do. Early on, it was very difficult to share information with them for fear it would be compromised or they would really do nothing with it. But we did some great bridge building, and I think right now we've got a really good relationship both along the border and with our agents working side by side in Mexico with our counterparts.
And after El Chapo is caught for the second time, I think, you moved to D.C. to take over as DEA Chief of Operations, which was, I believe, the number three position at the DEA. And, of course, El Chapo had been caught, but you heard chatter that he was already plotting a prison break and tried to warn your counterparts in Mexico and also people up the chain of command in law enforcement. How did you know that he was already plotting another escape?
Well, first of all, at that point, we really knew his ability to secure, I mean, quality engineers to build tunnels. We'd seen it for years along the border for drug trafficking. And so we were beginning to hear intelligence information from a variety of sources saying that he was in the process of planning to tunnel out. So I took the opportunity when I was down there for a meeting to pull aside the head of the federal police and tell him. And I believe this was in April. could be wrong. I think it was in April. And of course, he looked at me like, you know, how dare you come down and tell me how to do, you know, do his job. And that's really all you can do in those situations. And one of the things that was I was alarmed about was they all knew he was a tunnel expert, and they never moved him. They kept him on the same in the same cell for over a year, and it just happened to be on a ground floor. So several months after that meeting, Chapo rides out a motorcycle through the tunnel, and he's in the wind again.
Yeah, that's what I wondered when all this happened and he escaped for the second time through a tunnel. Did it never occur to anyone to put him on the second floor?
No. Well, it occurred to me, but no, the problem is nobody listened to me.
Yeah. And when he finally did escape again, I think it was probably in the middle of the night, you call your boss, the DEA administrator, Chuck Rosenberg, and tell him that El Chapo escaped again. What did he say?
Well, Chuck was brand new to DEA, and of course, he'd come over from the FBI. Mm-hmm. And he just asked me, could you tell me again who Chapo Guzman is? And of course, I did, and he remembered. But yeah, that was that kind of got my attention, too.
Yeah, I mean, by that time, wasn't El Chapo pretty well known, not just in your circles, but through the media as well?
Yeah, I think he'd become kind of a folk hero mm-hmm. to some people, and he was certainly in the media. It's interesting, that night I found out, and I talk about it in the book, I didn't find out from our command center in Washington. I found out from my son, who saw it on Twitter. And of course, that was the first time anybody in the agency knew. And it just showed at that point, I think the Mexicans were hesitant to tell us. And I think they thought they could have him back in custody in several hours, which obviously didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah, and you snapped right into action, and it gets into this manhunt for El Chapo for, what now, the third time? And in the most ridiculous scene in the book, you recall the moment when you guys had tracked El Chapo down to a valley in, I think it's called La Tuna. You have the Mexican Marines in place ready to raid his compound, and suddenly things go sideways for the stupidest of all possible reasons. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, we were we had been working, obviously, with the Marines down there trying to locate an area. And for several weeks, we kind of felt we had him in a very remote area. So the Marines, being as great as they are, made the decision to go and stage, and they were going to try to ascend on foot, because several times before they'd used helicopters, and of course you can hear those coming. And so I remember going to dinner with friends, thinking the operation was a go and it was their call when to do it. And then the next day, when I got my morning briefing, they said that they didn't execute, and I wanted to know why. And that's when we were told there were an American so-called journalist up there, along with an actress. And when I dug into it, of course, it turned out to be Sean Penn, who, by the way, is not much of a journalist.
Yeah. So they actually held off on the raid because Sean Penn and a Mexican actress might have been in the compound.
Yeah, it certainly influenced them, I'll tell you that.
Gosh, I think you say that you wanted to have Sean Penn and this Mexican actress prosecuted for obstruction. Why weren't they thrown in jail for that?
Well, because he claimed he was there as a journalist, and evidently the decision was made at the Department of Justice mm-hmm. that, you know, not to. But what I was most concerned about, and what I'm always concerned about, is the danger he put our Mexican counterparts and some of the U.S. agents in.
Yeah.
I still at night wake up fuming.
Finally, you've got El Chapo for the third time in prison. How did you get Mexico to extradite him quickly before he could slip through their fingers again?
You know, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons it was a national embarrassment to them, and I felt bad for them, quite frankly, when he did escape. And I think at that time they made a decision at the highest levels of government, we're going to go through the legal process, but the end game here is to get him out of Mexico. And you know, in thinking back, I just can't tell you how proud. First of all, I didn't single-handedly catch Chapo. No way. There were literally hundreds of heroic DEA agents, police officers, and prosecutors who really risked everything, not only to capture him, but to extradite him and have him face justice in the U.S.
Yes, and he finally did face justice. Very recently, El Chapo was tried here in the U.S. for his crimes. What went through your mind when you watched this person, whom you had described as the most evil man in the world, finally in court standing trial like any other crook?
I just reveled in it.
Yeah.
It's where he belongs, and he's going where he belongs. I really do believe that it's a fate worse than him taking a bullet in the head from his rival is where he's going to go, most likely to Supermax in Colorado. And between me and you, I hope he lives 150 years, because that's a heck of a place to be.
Yeah, I think in the book you said that there were reports that he was going crazy from the silence of being in prison and supposedly having hallucinations, right?
Yeah. Welcome to the real world, Chapo. It's your own doing.
Yeah. Now, did anything come out in the trial that might have even been a surprise to you?
No, not at all. I knew many of the agents and the prosecutors and their first class, and I also had a fairly good sense of how strong the evidence was. So now I knew he was in jail to stay. One of the things I do think that was kind of funny is I think there was a time right before the jury went out where the indications were that Chapo actually believed he might get acquitted.
Right.
And I just found that, I found that hilarious.
Well, I want to ask you a few questions more generally about the war on drugs, although I know you don't like that term, you say. In fact, why don't you like the term war on drugs?
Because I think we have to realize, you know, when you use a term like that, a war has a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as we're in existence, we're going to have to deal with addiction, the associated death and violence, and figure out a way to deal with the problem in general, not just the bad guys that we must go after. I mean, I think it's so vital for us to maintain a strong law enforcement posture, both domestically and overseas, and build relationships with our foreign counterparts. But at the same time, we got to rethink how we educate. We also have to realize that this country's never been in an epidemic like this, and that we have to be able to rethink how can we help people get them to treatment. And I'm not talking about the bad guys, the repeat offenders, the violent people. I'm talking about the everyday U.S. citizen who finds themselves in the grips of addiction, either through prescription drugs that led to heroin. And how do we effectively make sure that we make this treatment available to people that need it and want it and maybe can't afford it?
Well, Donald Trump promised the American people that he was going to tackle the opioid epidemic head on. As someone who's overseen the war on opioids personally, have you been impressed so far by his efforts?
To be honest with you, I think the real national emergency is the fact that 120 of our U.S. citizens are dying a day. They're estimating now some 70,000 people will lose their lives this next year because of drug abuse, and much of that is opioid-based. So, yeah, I think we got to do a better job. I know controlling the southern border is a good thing. I think the wall will have a effect on illegal alien migration, but until we step up our manpower and technology at the ports of entry, I'm not so sure we're going to have a big effect on stopping the flow of drugs. There's an old saying on the border, you know, you build a 10-foot wall, I'm going to get 11-foot ladder.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of the data seems to indicate that drug flow across legal entry points way outweighs the drug trafficking across the illegal parts of the border. Your experience bears that out from what you've seen?
Yeah, yes, sir. Especially, I mean, it just doesn't make financial business sense for cartels to move high volume of narcotics through desolate terrain and unwalled areas. When they can take advantage of the thousands and thousands of vehicles and people that cross in and out of Mexico every single day.
Right. Okay. So logistically, it's a lot easier to do that than driving across dirt in some empty prairie or something.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that doesn't occur, but the major stuff comes through. You know, if you just look 3 weeks ago, CBP seized a record load of fentanyl, synthetic heroin, and that came secreted in a compartment hidden on, I believe, an 18-wheeler. We'd never gotten it. At the port of entry if we did not have the ability to x-ray. So I would like to see some enhancement in that capability along with strategic barriers, which I do think will have an effect.
Yeah. And as someone who's spent a lot of time with border sheriffs inspecting the holes along the border, sometimes literal holes in the case of El Chapo's drug tunnels, do you think that a wall would actually at least slow down the flow of illegal drugs? And would it be a cost-effective way?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to look at is it would have some effect on smaller, I think, independent entrepreneur type traffickers, but the major cartels, the Sinaloas, I think because they're very, very good at using the ports of entry. You know, I think right now we're only X-raying 30-35%. So if you're Chapo Guzman and you send 10 cars at the same time across the border, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get 50-60% of that through. Mm-hmm. And you only got to bat 300 to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. You can see the business side of it.
And as someone who didn't want to focus on the small-time street dealers and so forth, I'm curious how you feel about the recent criminal justice reform law and the effort to release low-level drug dealers.
Yeah, I think that is an evolution that's been happening for a while. You know, it's important to understand, at least at the federal level, there are very few people in custody serving time for personal use, amounts of narcotics. And usually there's an element of violence connected to them. So, you know, to release nonviolent drug offenders, I guess, is an option that we need to look at. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to do it, and we have to do it very sparingly and making sure that people are who we think they are.
If you were in charge of the DEA today, what would be the number one thing that you would want to do to address the drug problem here?
I think, first of all, DEA right now is down, at least when I left, 500-600 agents.
Really?
We're authorized to hire those agents. We just don't have the budget. I would really push hard for that. And then I think, secondly, we need to maintain our presence overseas. We're in about 64 countries overseas. So we're attacking, for the most part, the countries in which the drugs are produced before they even get to the United States. Mm-hmm. And in some of those countries, we really do good work because we build institutions and we show how to establish the rule of law. And that is really important, not just for narcotics trafficking, but really for organized crime. It could be threatening the United States from any position.
Well, now that he's sitting in a prison cell, have you had any desire to sit down and speak with El Chapo? And what would you want to ask him?
I would just say I don't know how, you know, the thousands and thousands of innocent people that died because of him and his organization. You know, some of those images are seared in my memory. And I just like to know, just to make sure that he understands that he's responsible. And that's really it, other than I'd probably take a swing at him, but that would probably get me in trouble.
Probably. Well, again, the book is called Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. It's a great read. Jack Riley, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Special Agent Jack Riley for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.